The Buzzer After Hours. Who says nothing good happens after 2 a.m.? Music. Stories. Just dropped releases. The After Party. Dates from Hell. Nothing is taboo. Join us Wednesdays. After Hours.
Hey, Shay here. The Buzzer After Hours. Welcome. Episode 9. Today is the first of the series. What a long, strange trip it has been. Living just outside San Francisco, Warren was part of a psychedelic music scene, making friends with Big Brother and the Holding Company, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Sup with Camel, and Grateful Dead camps. He was a roadie for the Grateful Dead in the late 60s, before forging an incredible career in sound engineering. During his audio engineering career, he provided service and consulting for the likes of Rick James, Jesse Colin Young, MC Hammer, members of Huey Lewis and the News, Journey, Boss Skaggs, and many others throughout the West Coast. The likes of Lauren Green, Sly and the Family Stone, and Motown Records sought his expertise, among others. The series, What a Long Strange Trip It Has Been, is a compilation of memoirs as told by Warren Paul Harris. Enjoy. Hi, Warren. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Hi, Shay. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's amazing. You got such an interesting life. And we're going to talk about your stories and what you've done. But we're going to have to start at the beginning. Talk a bit about your childhood and how you first were attracted to the music business.
Well, as a child, I didn't live in a musical family, but as a child, I listened to the radio constantly. And that sort of being in Oregon in the 50s, that started with country western and morphed into rockabilly and then, you know, rock and roll. And so I was always interested in music. It's what really attracted me. And I always wanted to play music. So as a teenager, I really wanted to play drums because my interests were in percussion. I just thought it was really cool. And I wanted to play drums and I wanted to take lessons. And my parents said, no, those are too loud. And I said,
I got the same thing. Literally, that's an honest thing. I got the same thing.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't quite work out the way they planned because they had no idea how loud an electric guitar could be.
Yeah, cool.
And so I took up guitar lessons and I really enjoyed it. I like guitar. I always have. But, you know, drums was my first love. So, you know, I played guitar. I enjoyed it. And you know, I was never going to be a great musician, but I amused myself. So I think that's enough.
But question here, why didn't you move on to do bass then?
Oh, well, I do play bass. I used to play bass a lot, actually, but then I developed tendonitis in my wrists in my 30s. And I had to quit playing bass, and it was just far too painful to do anything for the longest time. And then eventually I outgrew that and then, you know, developed rheumatoid arthritis and a long list of other things, but my wrists are still okay. So I do occasionally play bass. I enjoy it.
So when you just looked into the music business, I've read before that you saw that many guitarists and musicians weren't doing so well on the financial side. So you decided to do a different path, but stay in the music business. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, it was sometime probably in the, I don't know, 70s. That I realized I knew a lot of really amazing guitarists. They were just spectacular, far better than I could ever possibly hope to be. One must be realistic about these things at some point. And I realized these people are washing dishes, painting houses, doing roofing or construction so they can afford to play music. And that simply was never going to meet my needs. But what I discovered around the same time is I had really exceptional ears. I heard things that other people didn't hear. And that's what has gotten me some gigs that I have engineered.
That's really cool. And you lived in close to Marin County?
Yeah, I lived right across the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin County and for a long time. But luckily, in that golden era from 1965 through 1967, Summer of Love, all the psychedelic rock bands, and it was a great time to be there.
Were you part of Woodstock?
I was not at Woodstock. I was, however, at the Human Being, which is the very first of these events in the Golden Gate Polo Fields in 1965 with... We had the Grateful Dead, we had Big Brother and the Holding Company, Quicksilver Messenger Service, the Airplane, Jefferson Airplane. A lot of people, plus Ginsberg and Kesey and Leary and all these amazing names from that period in time. And of course, Osley was present with all of his bag full of goodies. And the Hells Angels were operating the Lost Child Center.
They were?
I know. I was amazed.
You were what?
The Hells Angels were operating the Lost Child Center for this event. And I just thought, this is incongruous, but all right.
Oh, that sounds cool, but not so cool.
It wouldn't have been my first thought.
Yeah. So you must have saw a lot of bands around that time, because that was sort of a happening place.
Yes.
You saw the Doors?
I saw the Doors the first time they played outside of LA. It was just mind bending. I was entranced by the keyboard players' granny glasses and the reflections of the liquid light projection system in them.
Yeah.
And just the sound they had in general was unique.
Oh, they definitely were. They're one of my favorite bands, actually.
It was a treat, a real treat. I saw them three times live, and it was just always wonderful to see Morrison live.
And you saw Muddy Waters, I believe.
I did. I saw Muddy Waters and a lot of the greats. I mean, really amazing people. Clifton Chenier. I mean, just this wonderful, you know, almost Zydeco kind of music. A lot of the great blues players, lots of great acid rock, and Blue Cheer, the first big power trio. They started it, and they were really quite amazing live and never properly recorded. They just never captured it.
And Janis Joplin?
And Janis. And Big Brother and the Holding Company. Big Brother and the Holding Company literally drew the biggest crowds in this city. Compared to everybody else, they were an order of magnitude more popular. So the Avalon Ballroom was my favorite venue, and I had a lifetime pass to it because I knew somebody there. And that was kind of nice. And anytime you go there to see Big Brother, there would be a line four abreast all the way around the city block waiting to get in to see them. And when somebody would come out, more people would go in. And really it was Janis. She was just electric. She was a force of nature and such an interesting woman too. You know, she just had lots of energy. She was vibrant and you know, she would talk to anybody. I got to know Janis fairly well. And it was a real show. Just the energy that they put out was wonderful.
Janis Joplin that you saw on stage, was the Janis Joplin that was real?
Oh, yes. That was Janis. She was always on and she was always like that. But, you know, she was troubled. She was a very troubled woman, which is really too bad. You know, she was basically, as nearly as I can figure, self-medicating. And she had gotten a bum deal from her family and from the university, and she was just badly treated.
Yeah, she was badly treated. She did get clean for some time.
She did, yeah.
Yeah. And sadly, that happened. So were you part of the drug scene?
Well, yes. I started smoking pot in about 65. The Sop with Camel turned me on to pot. And I got out of the pot scene pretty early because I just found it made me stupid. You know, I couldn't focus.
Simple way of putting it.
I just felt stupid. I couldn't do anything. My reaction time was gone. I couldn't drive because I couldn't trust my reflexes. It made me nauseous too, and it made me sleepy. So it wasn't a great party drug. Mm-hmm. And I vastly preferred psychedelics. They were much more entertaining. So that was my That was my drug of choice for a really long time. And I may hold a record for the number of times I've done acid. I don't know. It's over 500 anyway.
Do you have any effects today for that?
Nothing that I'm aware of, other than I'm probably missing several billion brain cells that I could have used for something else.
Well, you're very healthy today, so you must have kicked the habit very early.
Yeah, I finally pulled the plug on that. But then there was the cocaine era, which was just kind of went with the territory. And you know, I had been using way too much cocaine and working crazy hours building recording studios. And at one point, I started drinking tequila and orange juice first thing in the morning to take the edge off the cocaine. So,
wow,
this is really a bad lifestyle. And I actually found myself standing in front of a mirror one day, 1981, I think it was, having a conversation with myself saying, okay, so listen, you've been peeing blood for 3 days. And you're really either going to have to stop this or just die. You know, it's going to be one of these two. So this is probably that point where you need to make that decision. And that's the day I quit.
Was it the crowd that you were with or the music business at the time?
It's self-medication is what it is. You know, it's whatever it is that's in your life that you think is uncomfortable or imperfect or not the way you want it to be. It's what causes people to do drugs for the most part. They're just trying to escape. And, yeah. You know, my observation has been that you can't escape what's going on in your life. You may take a holiday from it. And meanwhile, it just festers in your absence. So when you come back, it's generally gotten worse.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. So you were at a Big Brother concert and something happened with a mic.
Oh, yeah. this was probably 66 or so at the Avalon Ballroom. And my girlfriend at the time, who also ultimately became my second wife, and I always used to lay on the floor with our feet up against the stage so we could feel the vibration of the speakers through it. And this was a day when Jim Gurley, the guitarist for Big Brother, who died some years ago, who was amazing. I just loved his style. And he was a cool guy. And he was well lit before he even got to the stage. I would say he was well toasted and came dragging his guitar, holding it by the headstock and dragging the bottom on the floor. The tail end of the guitar is being dragged on the floor as he goes up the stage to the stairs of the stage. And they are playing through, you know, a pair of Standell Imperials and a custom 1500. So it's a big rig for the guitar, nice and loud. And in the first set, one of the Standells fries, and Janice steps up to the mic and says, "Is that our new Imperial?" And Jim just looks at her. He knows it is, and she knows it is, and she's bummed. And so he's down to two cabinets. In the second set, he's, you know, in the middle of a solo, and he grabs this dead amplifier in a death grip and starts swinging it around in a circle, you know, pivoting around him. And they're big and heavy. They're about 4 feet high. And his guitar is feeding back because of what's going on. And it's really intense. And my girlfriend and I are just laying there on the floor entranced by all this, watching this take place until the bottom of that cabinet whacks the mic stand. Uh-huh. And up until now, there'd been a photographer taking pictures of the two of us. He just thought we were really interested. And we thought we were interesting. And we thought, okay, fine. And we're watching the show and he's photographing us. And this mic stand comes hurtling towards our heads. And the photographer snatches the thing out of thin air and stops it. And we were just so transfixed, we wouldn't have done anything about it being, you know, what, 16 years old and, you know, focused on the music and not the mic stand that was about to clock us.
Wow.
We're very fortunate that photographer was there.
Yeah, you definitely were. And you said you knew Janice fairly well.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. She was, you know, she was really cool. She was a really interesting person. And back in that day, anybody could, you know, would talk to anybody. The bands didn't act like they were special. They'd come out and socialize in the crowd, you know, inconspicuously. But, you know, if you're paying attention, you could go find them and talk to them. It was pretty easy back in the 60s and 70s. It's not like that today.
And it was about 1970, right?
1970 was when she overdosed, yes.
Yeah. Did you get to see her before she overdosed?
No, she was recording at Sunset Sound in Los Angeles, and I was living in L.A. I was living in Glendale at the time, I think. And a friend of mine was a second engineer at Sunset. That was the first recording studio I'd ever been in, and he had called me to say she was tracking a new album. And I said, well, that's great. I got to come down and say hi. And I kept putting it off. And I put it off for like 3 days, and he called me in the morning and said, Janice overdosed last night.
Wow, that's sad.
And well, I said, well, hell. Yeah, it's really unfortunate.
Well,
she was a force of nature.
Yeah. Well, to this day, she is my favorite female vocalist of rock.
She was really amazing.
Yeah, amazing. It's interesting to know that she has the same nature that captivated people on stage. Yeah, but it's so sad that she had that and was mistreated. Like, it's a very sad story. Very sad.
It really is.
Yeah. So talk about your time with Lee Michaels.
Lee Michaels. Lee Michaels was a character. He was rehearsing in a rehearsal studio complex that I was working in back in, I guess, 76 or so is my guess. And they had a really big rehearsal space that they were in. And he was just a character. He drove a Checker, the Checker cab. They made their own cars. So these things are built like a tank.
Like, he drove it as a taxi driver or drove it as a car?
He drove it as a car. It was kind of an olive drab, I think it was. Kind of a greenish color. And he drove this thing like a wild man. He'd literally just drive up on sidewalks and through parking lots at breakneck speed. And it just, without regard to anything that might be around, you were on your own. If Lee was on the streets, you really needed to be alert. And it was a wild ride, I'll tell you that. And he also had a Lotus Europa. And they were really cool looking cars, but you frankly have to own two so you can drive one while the other one's in the shop. And there was a guy that did work on cars in one of the nearby centers. And he had this go-kart that had a Yamaha 750 three-cylinder engine in it that had clocked something like 119 at Sears Point, I think. And it was in its own big road case with wheels, so you could carry the thing around and unload it someplace. And Lee saw this thing and just thought it was the coolest thing he'd ever seen. And he traded the Lotus Europa straight across for this go-kart. Which I thought was a strange trade, but hey, why not? But Lee played keyboard and he played it really well. And at one point he decided he wanted to play guitar. And we came into the rehearsal studio one morning and everything had changed. There was literally a wall of orange amplifiers. And Lee had himself a new Les Paul and decided he was going to play guitar. And it was loud and it was pretty entertaining, but really not his forte. And it didn't last very long. He ultimately got rid of the big wall of amplifiers, went back to his B3, but it was entertaining for a little bit and loud. And he decided to build a set of drums for Frosty, the drummer, out of trash cans. So all different kinds of trash cans with the bottoms cut out and heads put on the top. All different sizes. And all assembled in a big drum kit, and it looked really cool, and it sounded exactly like what you would think it sounded like, trash cans.
Wow. What made him think of that?
I don't know. You never knew with Lee. That's the thing about rock and roll. People do a lot of funny substances and makes them think funny things.
Yeah.
Especially cocaine. You can get a lot done that doesn't accomplish anything on cocaine. You can do a lot of busy stuff. It never actually complete anything. So you'll see a lot of that. That's been my experience. You just get people get ideas and take off on a tangent, never complete it because they get another idea.
Yeah. I never got into that scene. I was like you. I think my entire life, I've had three times that I tried marijuana.
Okay.
All three times, never again. It's horrible. No, I didn't like it. The other, maybe once. It's something that I prefer to have a glass of wine, to be honest with you, if I'm going to chill. That I can see how it would create a lot of different avenues of thought.
Well, yeah, it's basically just scattered noise is what it is.
You know, yeah.
Just all these ideas. Let's do this. That sounds like such a great idea. And we get halfway done and think of something else. Well, let's go do that. This one's not finished, but we don't care.
So how long did that kit last?
Oh, not very long. That kit was maybe a week or so, and everybody decided, this sounds like garbage cans. It's not a soothing. It's not a nice sound. It's an annoying sound. It would have been great for a punk rock band.
You also had involvement and worked around or with Sly Stone and Santana?
Well, I worked with people from Santana's band.
Okay.
So when I worked for Motown Records in 74 and 75.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun. You know, it was really a great time to be there. Any time in Motown was probably a great time to be there, but this was a good time to be there. It was a lot of fun. The Temptations were recording their Black and Silver album for like a year and a half. And Commodores were recording. Diana Ross was recording. You know, everybody was recording in and out of the studio a lot. And it was really fun. And Diana Ross was doing a song that Jeffrey Bowen was producing. And the rule around Motown was if, you know, somebody wrote a song that one of their big stars elected to record, you could produce it. If you wrote it, you got to produce it. And Jeffrey Bowen was producing a song she was doing. I don't remember which one. And so I was up at his house to go check something on a sound system that he had there. And Sly Stone was there. And I got to talking with Sly, and he lived in Marin County. And he said, "Hey man, you know, when you're up here, look me up." And I said, "Okay, cool." And so, we went on vacation that year in August, drive back up to Marin County and visit some family and look around. I decided to look up Sly, and he said, "Hey man, you know, I'll hire you on at, $300 a week to keep track of all my stuff." And I said, "All right." Motown said, "We'll lay you off so you can collect unemployment if you feel like it." I said, "Okay." I wanted to get out of Marin, get into Marin out of LA anyway, because I just didn't want to raise my kids in LA.
Okay.
I've been there for 6 years and it was a good time to leave. But in fairly short order, I figured out that Sly just literally never paid anybody. He had this amazing ability to manipulate people. It was very clever. And watching him in the studio is also amazing, because the man is incredibly talented, but totally undisciplined. And so he'd never get anything completed. You know, he'd spend a lot of time in the studio, but no work would get done. And so Epic Records, part of CBS, put him in CBS studios in LA, where the engineer there was really going to make sure things got finished. That was his job. He was good at it. And I was in some of the sessions there with Sly, babysitting and taking pictures. And a lot of my images have been used by PBS and published in a lot of places in recent years. But Sly was so adept with any instrument that he would literally single track an entire song sometimes. So he would play drums, he would play bass, he would play keyboard, he'd do vocals, he'd do percussion, all of it himself.
Wow.
Just really that talented a man, but again, completely undisciplined. And what we would find with Sly often is he would, you know, he'd snort coke and smoke angel dust at the same time. So if you know anything about those two substances, that's a pretty weird combination.
Mm-hmm.
And he would literally fall asleep on the phone virtually once a day, be on the phone with somebody and just fall asleep. And eventually one of us would notice and go take the phone out of his hand and hang it up. And he would be oblivious to all this when he finally woke up. But his approach to dealing with all the hangers-on who had come there because he was going to pay them was that, you know, we're supposed to have checks arrive on Friday. And Friday, you say, "Hey, man, you know, I don't know what happened. The checks didn't arrive, but for sure they'll be here Monday." And Monday, end of the day, you say, "Oh, man, I don't know what happened. They didn't get the checks here again today, but for sure they'll be here Friday." And then Friday, the same thing again. "Well, I don't know what happened, but by certainly Monday, we'll have your checks." And, you know, you can string people along for a really long time that way, especially if they just really want to be around you because they think something cool could happen.
Yeah.
And I figured this out in pretty short order and said, "That will be enough of that for me. I'm done. This is not making me any money." And I went to work for different FIRST studios in San Francisco. They were looking for an engineer. And so I also at the same time was doing some sound for Cobra, which is an interesting band. And it had people from Sly's band, and it had people from Santana's band, including Chipito Arias on timbales. And I'm trying to remember the conga player's name. Michael, can't think of his last name at the second. Anyway, a lot of really talented cats, you know, playing in this band. And they were doing salsa rock.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And they were really good. So that was fun. It was a fun band. And we played a lot of gigs. We did a gig up in on Mount Hood in Oregon. And we took three RVs and caravaned up there to do this birthday party for somebody. That was fun. Did a couple of gigs along the way. You know, back when we had the time and the money to do that, it was a lot of fun. I wouldn't do it today.
Yeah. Show me. I've read about a funny story that you sent to me when you were loading into the Polk Street Club, the Palms.
Yes. Yeah. The Palms. Well, yeah, the same band, Cobra. Yeah. We had a young guy, Rhodey, helping us. I did the sound. He was the new Rhodey. And we'd been loading in and out of this club to set up for a gig. And there was this big black gay guy in Polk Street in San Francisco. It's a fairly well-known gay neighborhood. This big gay guy in a yellow and black striped jumpsuit. So he looks like a giant bumblebee. Has been sashaying up and down the sidewalk for quite a while we are loading in. And I come out, I'm getting stuff out of the truck, and my roadie comes up to me sputtering, just visibly sputtering and flustered and red in the face, saying, "Do you know what that guy did to me?" And I said, "I have no idea." "What?" He said, "He grabbed my ass." And I said, "Did he really? Do you have any idea where you are?" He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Read me the street sign." He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Look up at the street sign where it shows me what streets we're on and tell me what it says." He said, "Oh, it says Polk and Eddie." I said, "You don't know anything about this intersection?" He said, "It doesn't mean anything to you." He said, "No." I said, "This is a gay part of town. There are a lot of gay people here." He said, "Well, all right." And I said, "So take it as a compliment. And keep your back to the wall if you don't want it to happen again." You know? It was really funny. He was really flustered.
So I guess he wasn't used to the big city.
Probably not.
No, probably not.
Probably not.
What about Rocky and the Aliens?
Rocky and the Aliens. Well, Rocky Erickson was something of a legend. He died recently, not that long ago.
Oh, really?
It wasn't that long ago that Rocky died. Rocky was the founding member of the 13th Floor Elevators here in Texas, in the Austin area. And this is, I guess, 1965. They are known as being the first psychedelic album. And You're Gonna Miss Me was their big hit.
I'm going to look up that album.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, actually, especially for when it was made. And Rocky apparently had gotten into just a few too many psychedelics and spent a great many years in the care of the state of Texas in an asylum, from what I'm told. And then he got out and he formed Rocky and the Aliens. And Rocky was a wild looking character with a big full beard and a wild bunch of hair and fingernails that are a half an inch long and just very unkempt. And he smoked nonstop. So in the studio, when we were rehearsing, he would stand there in front of the microphone with cigarette after cigarette, and a pile of cigarette ash would accrue on the floor under where his hand was. He never made an effort to get near an ashtray. I don't even know if he knew such a thing existed. But Rocky was a real character and would be only too happy to spend a fair amount of time telling you that he was truly, you know, an alien, not an illegal alien, but actually an alien from some extraterrestrial location. He believed this. I'd be happy to bend your ear about it. And he had really interesting material, odd material. I mean, you should listen to some of his stuff. It's kind of really interesting. But live, I did their live sound. It was a cacophony of absolute just trash coming from the stage out of Rocky's amplifier. because first of all, it was anything but in tune. And second of all, Rocky had half-inch fingernails on his left hand, which if you've ever tried to play guitar, you know, really get in the way of the strings.
Yeah, so 100%.
It makes a horrible noise. I mean, it's just noise. And so it was just awful out front. So I did one session like that with them, one live gig, and I said, that was horrible. So the second time we go to do one of these gigs, it's at a high school auditorium. I'm thinking, how can I get him enough of himself so he can hear it and be thrilled with his sound and it doesn't just make everybody's ears bleed out front? And I thought, wait a minute, I know what we can do. And I checked with one of the stage managers. I said, have you got another stage wedge? You know, the speakers that they use so singers can hear themselves. He says, yeah, we got an extra one. I said, put it in front of Rocky's microphone next to his other wedge. And then we plugged that cabinet into his amplifier and unplugged the speakers that were in the amplifier. So the only thing that came out of that amplifier was going into the wedge straight into his face. And nobody else could hear it. And it was the best gig we ever did.
Did they ever figure it out?
No, Rocky was oblivious to this, but the band was thrilled. They liked it because it was very distracting to the band too. You couldn't tell whether you were on key or not with the racket that his guitar was making.
I really enjoyed our episode today and look forward to the next time that you're on to continue your stories. I look forward to reading the memoirs when it comes out and your episode on your photography and what you're doing in that space. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's a wrap for tonight. Episodes run every Wednesday. Who shows up for what we talk about? Who knows right now? Live on the edge. Just tune in and enjoy. See you next Wednesday. From my pad to yours, after hours. Subscribe feeds at thebuzzerpod.com. Cheers.